From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Dr. Lynn Emowitz of Physicians for Human Rights talks about her recent trips to Afghanistan, assessing the physical and mental health needs of women. Last month, she was in a displaced persons camp in the Kunduz region of Afghanistan, where women and children were living in holes, suffering from upper respiratory symptoms and malnutrition. The camp was shaken by the B-52 bombing on the front line 6 miles away. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a 1976 DVD reissue of The Ring Cycle and other works conducted by Pierre Boulez. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Mac Lee. Argentina's President Fernando de la Rúa has resigned after street protest over his government's handling of an economic crisis. The BBC's Tom Gibb has this report from Buenos Aires.
I'm behind Government House in the center of Buenos Aires, where President Fernando de la Rúa has just been taken away in a helicopter. The crowd here is celebrating the president's resignation. They're singing and waving flags. This is a victory celebration for them. All day they've been fighting riot police, who are still standing by and watching. Earlier on, the police repeatedly tried to clear the square behind me. They used mounted police, water cannon, tear gas and rubber bullets, often firing straight into the crowd, killing a number of protesters. The whole crisis started when President de la Rúa called a state of emergency to try to stop a wave of looting. This was supposed to stop public protests, but it had the opposite effect. People all over the city came out onto the streets banging pots and pans. Then the president tried to form a national unity government with the opposition Peronist Party, but this was rejected.
The BBC's Tom Gibb in Buenos Aires. The Pentagon is considering sending Marines to the Tora Bora Mountains of eastern Afghanistan to help in the search for Osama bin Laden. They could be used to dig out the caves that have been covered over in the aftermath of U.S. bombings. The New York Times reported that General Tommy Franks, the commander of American forces in Afghanistan, made the proposal to have Marines or Army troops investigate the caves that dot the mountainsides. Today, the U.N. Security Council unanimously approved the sending of peacekeepers to Afghanistan. Linda Fasulo is at the U.N.
By a vote of 15-0, Security Council members gave the green light to a multinational force to help Afghanistan's new interim government provide security in the capital city of Kabul. The peacekeeping force, which Britain will initially lead, is to be deployed for 6 months. 1,000 troops are expected to participate during the first phase, but diplomats say that number can expand to some 5,000. After some mixed signals, the new Afghan government agreed that the peacekeepers would use military force if necessary. Meanwhile, the United States Central Command is to have ultimate authority over the peacekeepers to ensure coordination with U.S.-led troops fighting the war in Afghanistan. For NPR News, I'm Linda Fasulo at the United Nations.
A decision on how to legally handle the American found fighting for the Taliban won't be made this week, despite recommendations from Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and Attorney General John Ashcroft. The White House says President Bush will delay his decision on which approach will be taken. In a televised interview, the wounded Californian admitted serving with a group of Arab fighters financed by Osama bin Laden. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 85 points to 9,985, the NASDAQ was down 64, and the S&P down 9. This is NPR News in Washington. President Bush has created an emergency board to help ward off a strike by mechanics at Chicago-based United Airlines. The 15,000-member mechanics union last week voted overwhelmingly to strike because of a contract dispute over pay. NPR's Jackie Northam reports.
The president created the emergency board with the sole purpose of settling a contract dispute between United Airlines and its mechanics union. The core of the dispute is pay. Mechanics haven't had a raise in 7 years and earlier this month voted to strike. The appointment of the presidential emergency board automatically prevents a strike or a lockout for 60 days. In that time, the board has 30 days to come up with a settlement. Then the airline and the union have another 30 to consider it before taking action. White House spokesman Ari Fleischer calls it a cooling off period. He says the president was concerned what effect a strike would have on the economy, particularly around the holiday period. Already, United Airlines says it's losing about $15 million a day. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Chicago.
Senators Joseph Lieberman and John McCain are calling for a nonpartisan commission to investigate the terror attacks on September 11th. The goal is to find out how the attacks could have happened and recommend ways to prevent them in the future. Lieberman, a Democrat from Connecticut, says the commission must not be a witch hunt, but a search for the truth. Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle is blaming the Bush administration and congressional Republicans for failure to produce an economic stimulus bill. Earlier today, the House passed a plan, but Senate Democratic leaders say it contained more tax breaks for big business than aid to the unemployed. Republicans say the Democratic leadership is blocking the measure, noting that several Democrats backed the president's plan. I'm Mac Lee, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Universal Pictures, presenting A Beautiful Mind, starring Russell Crowe and directed by Ron Howard, opens in select cities December 21st and theaters nationwide January 4th.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dr. Lynn Amowitz, has made several trips to Afghanistan in the past year and a half, conducting a study of human rights violations against women and the state of women's physical and mental health. Her survey has taken her to villages, refugee camps, and camps for internally displaced persons. Dr. Amowitz is a health and human rights fellow with the group Physicians for Human Rights. She's done medical work in Kenya, Rwanda, Sierra Leone, Albania, and Kosovo. She also teaches at Harvard Medical School and has her own private practice in women's primary care. Last month, she was collecting information from women in a displaced persons camp in Dasht-e-Kala, a mountainous area of Afghanistan. She was 6 miles away from the front line where American B-52s were bombing.
The day that I arrived, there was very little noise and very little bombing going on. However, the second day, we discovered that B-52s were flying over in the morning, and shortly after that, there were these ground-rattling and basically heart-rattling sounds, and it turned out to be the cluster bombs and 2,000-pound bombs that were being dropped on the nearby front line. The way that we would know that a bomb was coming was that in these buildings that we were staying in, which were sort of mud adobe huts, the plastic on the windows would suck in very fast, almost as though a sail on a sailboat has caught the wind and it slaps back and forth, and then you would hear this huge boom. In addition, behind the place that I was staying, which was with one of the humanitarian organizations, there was a large artillery piece that the Northern Alliance were shooting, probably to the front line, although it was never clear to me exactly where they were aiming. They said that what they were shooting was about 30 kilometers away. And so my question was, if I'm between the gun and 30 kilometers away, can the Taliban shoot back? And they kept saying, no, 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 it's not possible. We took out their guns. So we had two sounds. We had one of the American bombing, and then we had these huge artillery piece noises that just shook your body. And they, for some reason, always shot these off in the middle of the night every 20 minutes for about 6 or 7 rounds.
Describe the camp that you were in at the time of the bombing.
I was in a rather large internally displaced camp in Dasht-e-Kala, which was the city close to the front line. It was a very dusty area at the base of these sandy hills. It was dry, parched, cracked earth. You would see people who had dug into the ground to live in these camps and then had covered these holes with thatch, and they were living in there with all of their children. Primarily, those living in the holes in the ground were widows or those who were economically unstable or alone. There were some tents that were passed out by Concern Worldwide, which was a humanitarian organization which was primarily taking care of that camp. And they had just received these tents. But when you would go into the tents or you would go into these holes in the ground, you might see one blanket, one teapot if they were lucky, one cup, and maybe a handful of beans, but nothing of real material value.
Would you describe a little bit more of those holes in the ground that some people were living in? How big were they? Did you climb down into them? What's the air like inside?
I did climb down into these holes, particularly to talk to the women who were living in them or to talk to the children who were in them. And what they are they're about the size of a large dining room table. and they maybe they have built a sort of mud flat table where they can sort of sit around and have dinner if they are lucky enough to have anything, or they can just sit and talk. The thatch is always airy. In other words, you can see the sky and the clouds, meaning that if it rains or if it snows, in comes all of the elements. And then you would see a pile in the corner, usually of a blanket or a quilt, and then whatever belongings they had. There's no such thing as a store of clothes. There's no boxes. There's no paper. There's basically nothing but a whole dirt and maybe a couple of blankets.
This was a camp for internally displaced people. These were people who had to flee their homes in Afghanistan. What were some of the reasons that people were in this camp?
In my interviews with these internally displaced, we found that the majority of reasons that they left were because of Taliban atrocities. In particular, these were the Uzbek ethnicity women, and the Taliban had been incredibly grievous towards Uzbek and Hazara families. And a lot of what had been happening in these areas was land seizure, as well as a scorched earth method where they would come in and completely bulldoze a community, destroy the crops, and set the people fleeing to wherever they could get to. And so they would usually cross the front line and form these camps in order to find safety as well as food.
I've read excerpts of some of the interviews that you did with women in this camp, and some of them talked about how their husbands were shot. One woman said, "The Taliban shot my husband right in front of my eyes." Young men were forcibly conscripted to fight with the Taliban. I was wondering if there was much rape that was reported, and I ask that because rape is often one of the human rights violations that you report on a lot in times of war and civil war. But also, I'm curious, because it's the Taliban, because they have such a strict moral code, I wonder if there was any rape that accompanied that.
From our survey that we did a year ago, we found a very small number of women that admitted to rape. Now, this is a very difficult number to get at, because women, particularly in this society, would not necessarily ante up to having been raped because of the stigma associated with it. We also didn't necessarily gear the survey to specifically look at rape, as we did in Sierra Leone. However, we did get some cases, and in my interviews with these women in the IDP camp in Dashti Kalaa, there were some reports of women stating that girls, particularly young girls, were taken repeatedly from areas or villages from the front yard, so they were taken by the Taliban. It is also interesting to note that when I asked what language the Taliban spoke, they said that they didn't know what the language was, meaning that these were probably foreign Taliban or not Afghan Taliban. And it also turns out that lately there have been some reports surfacing that particularly among Arab, Chechen, and Pakistani Taliban, that rape was quite common and does go against their sort of strict moral code. But these were not the Afghan Taliban. These were the recruited al-Qaeda Taliban fighters, or foreign fighters, as the IDPs put it.
I imagine most of the women were looking forward to the possibility of returning home. Do you think that they'll be able to do that now that the Taliban have been ousted from power?
To go home is definitely what they want. Whether that is logistically possible is difficult to say. First and foremost, there are 700 million acres of mined land in Afghanistan. So going back to an area where the deminers have not been able to go to is a problem. And while I was there, two of the men in the village went back, or from in the IDP camp, went back to assess whether it was safe to go home. When they stepped into their homes or their huts in the village, they were actually blown apart by landmines. So first, they have to deal with the landmines. Second, you have to pay to cross the river in the area that I was in. And the river crossing was getting incredibly expensive. At first, it was $5 at the beginning of the week. By the end of the week, it was almost $100. And many of these internally displaced don't have that type of money to cross the river. And so they would try to cross the river on their own without using the pontoon. And many of the children were drowning in this swift-running river.
Who was collecting the money at the checkpoint?
These were all Northern Alliance.
What's your impression of what they were doing? Do you think that they were just like extorting money from people?
You know, the Northern Alliance, I don't think, are good guys either. But there's also a breakdown between the upper-level Northern Alliance commanders and the sort of infantry and local leaders. And those guys have very little structure and command and tend to do whatever they want to do. At this river crossing, it was run by the Northern Alliance. And, you know, you also have to remember not to ever say that they're doing the right thing. But these people are the people that are from the villages as well. They're just as poor as the internally displaced. The only difference is that they have a gun. And so they're able to lobby for money. So they were charging for the river crossing. It's also interesting to note that when I was interviewing some of the internally displaced in other camps, there was a point where a Northern Alliance group came through one of the IDP camps and force conscripted the boys out of the camp as well. So it wasn't just the Taliban.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Lynn Emowitz. She's a health and human rights fellow with Physicians for Human Rights. She also teaches at Harvard Medical School. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more about your experiences in Afghanistan. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Lynn Emowitz. She's a health and human rights fellow with Physicians for Human Rights. She was in Afghanistan last month at a camp for internally displaced people in Afghanistan, and at the time she was about 6 miles away from B-52 bombing. Let's talk a little bit about the health conditions in the camp that you were in. What were the biggest medical problems you witnessed?
Most of the medical problems in this camp were primarily upper respiratory infections. This area in particular in the Northeast is considered, quote, food secure, meaning that food has been able to get there on some regular basis, although it was a month before I had gotten there that they had gotten their last shipment of food. But if you walk the camp, you didn't see children that were severely malnourished. And Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders, had been doing malnutrition surveys in the camp. And the children made mild malnutrition, which almost half of children in Afghanistan make criteria for anyway. And half of children in Afghanistan are stunted from chronic malnutrition. But for the most part, what you saw were upper respiratory infections.
Well, you've reported that a lot of women in their mid-30s in Afghanistan already have 6 to 8 children.
That's correct.
What effect does that have on them physically?
Physically, to have 6 to 8 children in a short span of years is very hard on any woman. I mean, if you ask any woman in the U.S. how bad was their pregnancy, they always have a horror story. These women just seem to grin and bear it. The problem is that Afghanistan has one of the highest maternal death rates in the world. Every 30 minutes, a woman dies in childbirth. And then again, it also has one of the highest infant child mortality rates in the world. So I think a lot of these women are counting on the fact that they're going to lose a portion of their family in a very short amount of time, and that having more children assures that you have children for your future as well. They do quote that 1 in 5 children will not see the age of 5, which is a huge number of children dying every year. About 85,000 children a year die.
I was thinking, too, that, you know, under the Taliban, there was a period when women doctors weren't allowed to practice, but then I think women doctors were allowed to have women patients. Correct me if I'm wrong on that, but it must have been very difficult for women under the Taliban to talk openly to their doctors about medical problems they were having.
I think if women were able to see women, it was not such an issue. The problem arose if a woman under the Taliban needed to see a male doctor, then it became much more difficult, and meaningful diagnosis was almost impossible, given that they were not allowed to be completely examined. So if you complained of a cough, a male physician could only listen through traditional dress to your lungs, but couldn't listen to your heart. So if you were an older woman and you were having heart problems and that's what was giving you the cough, then it would be undiagnosed. They were able to access medical care. However, in the Physicians for Human Rights survey that we did, we found that the main reason that they couldn't access care was not because it wasn't available. We also found that there was an increase in the access and quality of care, largely because of the international community. But the reason that they couldn't access care was because financially they couldn't afford it. And this was, of course, directly due to the fact that women were no longer allowed to work under the Taliban.
Did women feel comfortable in your interviews with them, talking with you openly about their experiences under the Taliban and about their gynecological health care and what they were able to get and what they were unable to get?
The women definitely felt comfortable with me. I had spent a lot of time prior to actually going into Afghanistan of trying to integrate in the Afghan communities, learning to speak a little bit of Dari, learning the rules of the road, you know, what to do and what's not appropriate when you go into somebody's house. But I also used local data collectors. I felt that me going in and asking questions of these women would not be appropriate if I could use local data collectors. And so I used local women in each area that I was in to help me collect this data. When I did the interviews, some of them, as you know, trying to get as many as we could, I did have a translator who I sort of trained to ask the questions, and I would, you know, ask her to translate the question for me. But I never had any woman that I perceived as feeling uncomfortable, and I got horrendous stories told to me, as well as very personal things, including things like I tried to commit suicide, which is something that you wouldn't tell a stranger.
Well, in fact, you report that a lot of women tried to commit suicide. What was the suicide rate and the attempted suicide rate that you found?
The attempted suicide rate ranged from 9% to 16%, 16% being in the Taliban-controlled areas and 9% being in the refugee camps in Pakistan and the non-Taliban-controlled areas. But you have to remember, if this woman was able to say, yes, I attempted suicide, then that's a woman who failed the attempt. So that number is probably much higher because those who succeeded I would never be able to capture. Some of the other staggering statistics that we found about mental health was that more than 70% of women made clinical criteria for depression, and that means that they had depression that needed to be treated. And as well, more than 70% of women felt as though their life would be better off if they were dead, so that they hadn't moved towards wanting to try and kill themselves, but they were thinking that life would just be better if they ended. And this is a crisis among women in Afghanistan.
What does depression mean in a situation like Taliban-controlled Afghanistan, where if you're a woman, you have every reason in the world to be depressed? You have no rights. You can't leave the house unless you've totally covered up. You basically don't exist in society. So it's not like, oh, it's just a kind of chemical imbalance that you're facing or a period that will pass. I mean, there's every political and social reason to be depressed. It's not something that you'd necessarily want to go to a doctor for. You'd want to go to a different political leader.
I mean, you're absolutely right that depression is multifactorial, or there are many reasons that you can be depressed. And we did try to get at this in our survey, and we asked how much of your depression is due to Taliban policies. It was interesting that in the Taliban-controlled area, 70% of women said that their depression symptoms were related to those policies. But that also leaves 30% who said no, it had very little to do with their depression. And then in the non-Taliban-controlled areas, where the Taliban didn't exist and none of these policies were part of their everyday, 30% of women also blamed the Taliban. When we went back to look at this, we found out that some of these reasons were that it had been 23 years of war, they had destitute poverty, the drought for the past 3 to 4 years had ruined their crops, and they were no longer able to work and to have a financial status at all, that they had lost family members, that they felt internationally isolated. So there were many reasons. So yes, you can't fix depression primarily by treating it with a medication. Some of this is what we would call situational, that the situation is so bad. But that just shows you that if you're going to treat these women, that you not only have to treat the emergent ones, so those who really feel like life is not worth living, but you also have to work on all of these other basic human rights, like food, shelter, security, and emergency provisions.
In the United States, we've really focused on the burqa as a symbol of the oppression of women by the Taliban in Afghanistan. What did you find about how women in Afghanistan feel about the burqa?
Women in Afghanistan don't completely understand the Western obsession with the burqa. And actually, what the women in Afghanistan call it is a chadari. A burqa is a general term for any type of veil, but the Afghan chadari is the one that everybody knows, the blue with the mesh in the front. What they told me when we surveyed them was that 90% of women in the northern areas, not controlled by Taliban, chose to wear this or wore this on their everyday. In the non-Taliban controlled areas, about half of the women said that they really didn't care about the issue of whether they were punished for wearing this or not, also because half of them chose to wear this. My sense of this is, look, if you take off the chadari or you take off the burqa, it doesn't change their risk for tuberculosis. It doesn't change the fact that they will get education or health care, and it doesn't change the fact that they'll die in childbirth, and that all of these issues are far more reaching than simply talking about what they choose or don't choose to wear.
What insights did you get about how much the oppression of women in public life carried through at home with their husbands?
When we interviewed these women, we also had a chance to interview the husbands or a male relative. And what we asked the men, similar to what we asked the women, were what were your opinions about women's human rights? You know, should women have equal education, participation in government, occupation, and all of these rights that have been taken away? 90% of men in both Taliban-controlled and non-Taliban-controlled areas supported women's human rights. So we have this grand feeling that they definitely support them and that what the Taliban were saying were the voice of the people was not true. And we did see this. Herat was not taken by the Northern Alliance. Herat was actually taken by those in Herat who rose up and said, okay, had enough, Taliban, go. We want our city back.
Dr. Lynn Emowitz is a health and human rights fellow with Physicians for Human Rights. She teaches at Harvard Medical School. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Wreck the Halls, A Holiday Mystery by Sarah Graves, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews DVD recordings featuring conductor Pierre Boulez. And we continue our conversation with Dr. Lynn Emowitz, who has traveled several times to Afghanistan for Physicians for Human Rights. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dr. Lynn Emowitz. She's a health and human rights fellow with Physicians for Human Rights. Her current work for the group is in Afghanistan. She was there last month and hopes to return in January. She's also done medical work in Kenya, Rwanda, Sierra Leone, Albania, and Kosovo. Dr. Emowitz teaches at Harvard Medical School and has a private practice in women's primary care. You've made several trips to Afghanistan. Give us an overview of when you went and what your missions there have been.
Over the last 18 months, I've made 5 trips to the region. 3 of those were in Afghanistan. The first 4 trips were for completing this large-scale population study of health and human rights issues among women, as well as the opinions of human rights among women and men in both the Taliban-controlled areas and non-Taliban-controlled areas, meaning that I had to get into Taliban-controlled areas to do part of this study. The last trip was changed because of the situation. Originally, it was to go and to talk to the internally displaced, since I didn't have a chance to do that previously. But the situation changed a few days after I actually crossed the border, and so I had to modify what I was doing. But the one thing that I wanted to find out was to figure out who were the most vulnerable and what type of programs could be made to try and help those most vulnerable, meaning widows and women who need the most help in getting back to their villages.
Did you travel alone during your trips through Afghanistan?
On each trip, I did travel alone. It was somewhat easier to travel alone given the circumstances, particularly in Taliban-controlled areas, because you don't really want to gather a lot of groups of people and a lot of attention.
You wore a burqa?
I did not. I did wear a chador or a headscarf and Afghan dress, only because it made it easier to go through the villages and to go through the markets to get what I needed.
Why was it easier that way?
If someone comes from you from behind, they don't necessarily know that you're Western, although in some areas where women are supposed to wear a chadori or the burqa, it was important to have that. I was actually asked by the Taliban officials in the area not to wear it, and thought that that was a reasonable request, given that I wanted to downplay my existence there.
They asked you not to wear it because it would be inauthentic for you to wear it, or what?
Because it would be inauthentic was their reason.
Mm-hmm. So did you feel like you called a lot of attention to yourself as a woman who wasn't as covered as the Afghan women were?
Well, I didn't necessarily go into the villages or into the open areas or the market areas unless I absolutely had to. I stayed with families in the areas that I was in, and mainly because it was safer. It was also a way to get to know the community better by staying with families in the area. So I didn't go out to make myself visible, only when I was accompanying the data collectors or doing my own survey.
You know, I think for women traveling alone, there are two opposite extremes you get concerned with. One is that people will be very patronizing toward you because you're a woman alone, and the other is that people will try to prey on you sexually because you're alone. But I imagine traveling through Afghanistan, there's like a totally different option, which is that you're a woman, you have no rights, you're not supposed to be out alone in public, you're just like a different kind of creature, a fairly unacceptable creature. Tell me if I'm exaggerating here, but what was the experience for you of just being a woman trying to go about your business?
First of all, I never felt safer than when I was in Afghanistan.
Why?
Alone. It was just an incredible experience to walk and feel as though I was respected, and I'm not sure why that was. Perhaps they just thought I was completely crazy and that the best thing to do was just to stay away from me because I may do something, you know, unpredictable. I did meet with Taliban officials in every area that I went to get permission to do the study, and I never had a problem. Now, the one place I definitely felt unsure about being alone was on the Tajik side of the border crossing in Afghanistan. And that was because it was young Russian border guards who wanted to deny my access despite the fact that I had all the necessary paperwork. And so they wanted me to stay in their, quote, hotel overnight, and then they would let me pass in the morning, at which point I pulled out my sleeping bag, sat in front of the gate, and said, sorry, I'll just sleep here for the night and you'll let me across. By the time I had done this, they were just so flustered after 5 hours of going back and forth about this, they let me across. And I truly felt so much safer on the other side, even though I crossed the border at night alone into Afghanistan, into an area that I hadn't been in previously, because I knew that the Afghans would respect me.
Now, you said in all of the villages that you were in Afghanistan, you had to get the permission of the Taliban to do your research. I'm surprised that they didn't feel threatened by the research that you were doing.
I think part of the problem is they don't read. And so I would offer up the survey, which had all of the questions on it. I would explain what was on the survey, and then I would say, you know, if you want to read the survey to figure out what's going on, you're welcome to do so. And I think losing face in front of a Western woman and saying, I'm sorry, I don't read, since the majority of the Taliban are uneducated and illiterate, was not an option for them. And so they would hand back the survey and say, okay. On the other hand, the Taliban were never one group. It was a very mixed group. There were those who were fanatical, and then there were those who were Taliban because it was the way to assure that you would get food and a government position and an ability to stay in your village. So depending on who I met with, depended on what kind of access I could get. And fortunately for me, I met with those who had no problem with what I was doing.
Now, I know you have a baby, and I think on at least one of your trips, you took your baby with you to Afghanistan. Yes?
Yes. Not into Afghanistan. I tried to get a Taliban visa in August of this year. My baby was 6 months old at the time. I'm sorry, 7 months old at the time, and I was still nursing her and felt like there was no reason that I couldn't take her, so I took her along. She turned out to be a lot of fun in the refugee camps and actually put women at ease. But, you know, if you ask these women, did they think it was extraordinary that I took my baby, they would have just laughed. I mean, here they are living in a refugee camp in Pakistan, trying to find food for their family, and, you know, I'm just bringing my baby, who I just take home at the end of the day. I don't live in this situation.
Still, though, by taking her with you, you were exposing her to a lot of the contagious illnesses in the camps, whereas the people who are forced to be there have no choice. You did have a choice.
I did have a choice, but she was nursing, and therefore she had all of my antibodies. So every single shot that I've ever had, which is a lot, she was getting antibodies from this. When I had this discussion with my pediatrician, she felt as though that the risk was very small, given that she would primarily be with me and, you know, we would not be there in a prolonged period of time.
Did it help to know that you're a doctor, and if something went wrong, you could, like, diagnose it and treat your baby?
Oh, gosh, no. I'm still a mother, and I don't do pediatrics.
So you were as insecure as any of the rest of us would have been?
Oh, absolutely. I cannot go to the pediatrician with my children. I also have a 5-year-old, and when they need to go to the pediatrician, I send my husband with them.
Were people any more welcoming or any less suspicious of you when you had your baby with you?
I think that's probably the case, that, you know, if here's a Western woman, or as the yellow-haired, green-eyed woman, as they called me there, bringing her baby, then she can't be doing anything awful. I mean, the suspicion in these areas, if you are Western and particularly American, is that you are somehow intelligent. And by bringing my baby, that sort of put them at ease. Also, in August the previous year, I was there finishing the study in Afghanistan and was pregnant with her at the time. And then all of the women figured out that I was pregnant, even though I didn't think I was showing at the time. And that also seemed to put them at ease, that if I, you know, would come, even though I was pregnant, that I could be doing very little that was bad.
My guest is Dr. Lynn Emowitz. She's a health and human rights fellow with Physicians for Human Rights. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Lynn Amowitz, and she's a health and human rights fellow with Physicians for Human Rights. She teaches at Harvard Medical School. We're talking about the trip she's made to Afghanistan in the past, what, 18 months?
18 months, yes.
Why do you do the work that you do?
Huh. Everybody has asked. I do it because I'm afraid that if I don't do it, nobody else will. And I have all of these sort of mishmash of skills that seem to fit with the type of work that I do in talking to women, in conducting scientific studies to better understand the situation in all of these countries that I go to. And I am truly afraid that if I didn't go, who would do it, and that it wouldn't get done and that these issues wouldn't be dealt with.
Some of the places that you've been to, in addition to Afghanistan and Pakistan, are Sierra Leone, Rwanda, Kosovo, Albania, Kenya. What was the most kind of awful and surprising situation you found yourself in?
I think Rwanda was probably the most horrible of the situations that I've been in. I landed just after the Hutus and Tutsis had stopped fighting, or the genocide of the Tutsis had stopped, and the bodies were still on the side of the road. And at that time, I was helping UNICEF to establish an orphanage in Goma, Zaire. And each day I would walk from where I was staying to this orphanage, and along the way, I would always pick up one or two or more dead or dying babies that had been abandoned by their mothers. A lot of these babies, in retrospect, were probably babies that were born out of a rape that happened in Rwanda. And every day I would try and resuscitate these babies, and every day seven or more in this orphanage would die. It was just horrendous. And I, you know, didn't go into pediatrics because I can't handle taking care of sick kids. I have too much motherly instinct, and I end up in tears. And I just spent the entire time that I was there in tears.
You have a report that's due out in January about rape in Sierra Leone, and you're not at liberty to discuss the findings yet because the report hasn't been released yet. But I'm wondering, since you've studied rape in various war-torn cultures, do you find that rape is regarded in places like Sierra Leone, Rwanda, Afghanistan, in the same way that rape is regarded here? Is the language the same? Is the interpretation of rape the same? Are the reactions to it by women who have been victimized similar to the reactions of rape victims here?
I think the reactions of any woman who was raped is the same no matter what society you're in. And I don't think that you can say that it's different, that women that are raped here are any different than women that are raped in Sierra Leone. The fact that it is rape, the fact that it unravels your being, your society, your family, all of those issues are the same. You're stigmatized, your family is stigmatized. Now, in some countries where family and extended family is more important, such as in Afghanistan or Sierra Leone, then that becomes a big issue because it determines your survival. Whereas here, you don't necessarily lose your family or lose your house, lose your belongings, or lose your life because of the high rates of HIV in Sierra Leone. So it is a different ending, but the feelings and the feelings of trauma and lack of self-worth and all of those issues are very similar.
I want to get back to something we were talking about earlier, and that is that when you crossed the border from Tajikistan into Afghanistan, you felt more respected in Afghanistan than in Tajikistan, and therefore you felt safer too. I'm not sure I understand the meaning of respect in that context, since it's also a culture that at the time was under the Taliban, in which it just seems to me women had very little respect.
Yeah, I think that's a hard thing to understand. But basically, on the Tajikistan side, my sexuality was an issue, whereas my sexuality on the Afghan side was not an issue. I did not worry that they were going to drag me away or put me at risk for being assaulted on the Afghan side, and that they would be somewhat standoffish. Whereas There were no bounds on the other side. There was no respect. And I don't really think on the other side, on Tajikistan side, where the Russians are patrolling this border, that they have much respect for anybody, whether it's a woman or a man. But certainly a woman to them is a lot less secure, if you want to put it that way, than if it's a man.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Lynn Amowitz. She's a health and human rights fellow with Physicians for Human Rights. She teaches at Harvard Medical School. You have private patients in your practice in Boston, but you've been around the world working with women in war, women in refugee camps and displaced persons camps. Do you ever think the women in your private practice are spoiled because they're complaining of medical problems that would seem so minor in comparison to the problems of women in war?
Never spoiled, but awfully lucky. I mean, I just sometimes have to sit and say, you know, you have the right to complain about this because something can change. Whereas the women that I've treated in the past in these other camps and in these other parts of the world, there is nothing for me to do other than to say I understand and give a hug and that's it. I do have some adjustment problems when I come back. The most notable one was coming back during residency from Rwanda. And my first day back, I ended up having to be the resident in the medical intensive care unit. And the medical intensive care unit was full of 80 and 90-year-old women and men who were being treated for things that were never going to be treated and that they would probably die. And I had an incredible difficulty adjusting to that situation, and ended up losing my perspective for a little while.
What was particularly difficult about that?
There was always in intensive care units, there's always sort of an interplay between the residents and the nursing staff and the patients who are usually completely out of it. And the nurses who primarily take care of these patients, you know, you go home, they're still there, and they take care of these patients day in and day out. And there was an argument that started between one of the nurses and I about how much potassium to give someone, whether it was 20 milliequivalents or 40 milliequivalents, at which point I just blew up and said, look, if you want to give 40, give 40. I just spent 6 weeks picking up dead babies and trying to resuscitate them, and we're trying to resuscitate a 90-year-old woman who has, you know, metastatic cancer or a cancer all over her body. What more do you want me to do?
And how would you feel about that now? Same way? Same kind of difficulty adjusting?
No, I think I've, you know, over the years have learned to readjust better in this regard and coming back and realizing that, you know, we're some of the luckiest individuals in the world with regard to medical care. But I do have some readjustment problems when I come back for a couple of weeks in just realizing or feeling as though what I'm doing here is not as meaningful as what I'm doing other places. However, there's always that one patient that reminds you what you're doing here is very meaningful. When I start seeing patients at home again and I am able to make a patient feel better, then I realize that this is really my job, and this job helps what I do in the field just as much as what I do in the field helps at home.
Dr. Amowitz, I thank you so much for talking with us. I wish you good health, be safe, and I wish you good holidays. Thank you.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Dr. Lynn Amowitz is a health and human rights fellow with Physicians for Human Rights. She teaches at Harvard Medical School. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz reviews DVDs featuring conductor Pierre Boulez. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Post-September 11th terrorist anxiety touched the music world when Swiss police investigated French conductor and composer Pierre Boulez. Music critic Lloyd Schwartz says his favorite living musician is making musical news as well.
Pierre Boulez made headlines recently, but not for his music making or Grammy Awards. The police in Basel, Switzerland, evidently dragged the 76-year-old musician from his hotel room in the middle of the night, confiscated his passport, and detained him for 3 hours as a terrorist threat. There are two versions of this story, which broke a month after the events in question. The British newspaper The Guardian reported that he was put on the police list because threats were made, surely not by him, to a hostile music critic after a particularly negative review. The BBC News reported that he made the list because of a comment he made when he was an apostle of the avant-garde back in the 1960s, that opera houses should be blown up. It's true, artists are dangerous, real subversives. They make us rethink our knee-jerk responses. But they're not literalists. What they say needs to be interpreted. We can see how Boulez wanted to revitalize opera in the new DVD of his radical 1976 production with director Patrice Chéreau of Wagner's epic four-opera Ring Cycle. Wagner's grandson Wolfgang, the director of the theater at Bayreuth, Germany, built especially to perform Wagner's operas, was looking for a new view of this cycle to celebrate its centennial. Boulez and Chéreau gave him one of the great stage productions of the 20th century, not the usual glorification of German mythology by Hitler's favorite composer, but an exploding of conservative opera tradition, with a moral indictment of the greed and hypocrisy of the Industrial Revolution and its effect on the 20th century. Chéreau's deliberately anachronistic images are visually stunning. The Rhine is a hydroelectric dam. The Rhine maidens are prostitutes. In their frock coats and glamorous evening gowns, the gods look like a family of wealthy 19th century industrialists. A huge pendulum hangs in their private chamber of Valhalla, reminding us their days are numbered. Men in the chorus, in shabby suits and ties, look like German workers in the 1920s, a mob out of one of Bertolt Brecht's political plays. The modern world is directly implicated in this myth, which may be exactly what Wagner had in mind to begin with. But here, the usual Wagnerian heaviness is gone along with the horned helmets. Boulez makes the orchestra fluid and transparent. The singers are subtle actors who actually look their parts, and they can sing with both grandeur and conversational intimacy. Here's the first entrance of the poignantly beautiful soprano Gwyneth Jones as the youthful, exuberant Brunhilde, whose affection for the mortal Siegmund will precipitate tragic, even cosmic consequences. If ever a musical work was made for DVD, it's The Ring Cycle. How sparkling the images look, and how satisfying to replay a favorite scene without having to wind back and forth searching through 14 hours of videotape. Several other Boulez performances have also come out on DVD. Brilliant concerts from Cologne and Frankfurt with the London and Chicago Symphony Orchestras of 20th century masterpieces. It's great not only to hear, but to see the master at work, and the cameras really focus on him. If he's ever arrested again, at least while he's moldering in prison, there are still these documents of his dazzling technique and Cat Got the Canary grin, and we can watch them whenever we like in the comfort of home.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed new DVDs of Pierre Boulez conducting Wagner's Ring Cycle and Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and sponsored in part by Nonesuch Records, featuring composer John Adams' El Nino, an oratorio on the Nativity story featuring Lorraine Hunt Lieberson, Dawn Upshaw, and Willard White, conducted by Kent Nagano. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, our film critic John Powers talks about new movies opening for the holidays, and he gives us his picks for the best films of the year, and Maureen Corrigan tells us her favorite books of the year. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.